We are in week 7 of an 8-week series looking at a group of churches that collectively receive the entire book of Revelation in the form of a letter from John in about 95 AD. And not only did this entire group of churches receive that letter, but each one has a specific portion that's directed right at them, found at the end of chapter 2 and the beginning of chapter 3 in the book of Revelation that's in our Bibles today. And this week's city is Sardis. And Sardis, in many ways, is the very opposite of the city that Steve talked about last week, which was Philadelphia. Philadelphia, if you remember from Steve's teaching, was a small church with a big faith. Sardis was a big church with a dead faith. Jesus had nothing bad to say about Philadelphia, and as we're going to see today, he has very little, probably nothing good to say about or to the people in Sardis in the words that we find in Revelation. Even today, Philadelphia is a small city that you can go visit. People live there, and you would not know that there is an ancient city that lies underneath. It's completely unexcavated. Sardis today, there's nothing there. There's some friends of mine. We've visited Sardis. If you remember, Steve showed a picture of me in Thyatira a couple weeks ago. There are actual pictures of me in Thyatira if you want to see those. And there's a group of us, and there's not much there in Sardis right now. All that's there really is the excavation that a team from Harvard came and did in about 1962. It spent several years, especially in the lower city, excavating. And it's probably the most well-excavated of the seven cities, with the exception, for sure, of Ephesus, I would think. Sardis was founded in 600-ish BC by the Lydians under King Croesus, who was the wealthiest man in the world at that time, at least historians say. And as you can see from this area, one of the reasons why is just an absolutely beautiful place and very, very fertile. Right there you can see a vineyard right on the hillside. Those are all over this area where Sardis used to be. There's two rivers that run through that valley that meet together, the Hermus River and the Pactolus River. The Pactolus River had gold in it, and still there's people that find gold there today, and that's another reason why they found this would be a great place to settle. In addition, the Acropolis that you see in the picture there made it a very, very easy place to protect and to put a military presence up top, and so that's why Sardis was originally a good idea, at least in the mind of the Lydians back in 600 BC. Historians say that Sardis may have been the very first place that minted coins. They had so much gold that they collected, they started putting them into coins. I don't know if that's true or not, but some scholars say that. But the grape harvest, the vineyards, was a big part of their culture. Now, if you look at an overhead photo of the city, you can see the way it was structured. This is the Acropolis that you just saw. The person who had taken the picture previous was standing in the lower city looking to the, this is to the south, up the hill there. This part is unexcavated. And then to the west, you see that there would have been a outside of the wall, because this is in the Roman time, the wall that would have gone around the city, a temple to the goddess of Cybele that we're going to talk about in a minute. I just wanted you to see where that was. The road that went right through here is probably very similar in location to the way the road would have gone in the Roman times. The Romans, by the first century, had built 57,000 miles of roads that were still cars could drive on today. I mean, they're just incredibly strong. And there's that's not the road in Sardis, that's Corinth. But you could see the advanced nature of their design and everything of their roads. It was just incredible. Let's look at the Acropolis for a moment. You can see there's still some remnants of the wall up there still today. There's a little bit of there's some wall, a little bit of space up there now. And you can see again, this is a picture looking from the lower city up to the Acropolis. Very, very difficult for armies that were trying to attack Sardis to be able to penetrate the citadel there. And I also have a picture looking from the Acropolis down at the lower city right there. With a good lens, you can see the lower city down below. Now, what happened with Sardis was very quickly after they got founded, they became pretty satisfied with their position. Sardis was, like I said, impenetrable because of the Acropolis there. But in 546 BC, Sardis actually fell to the Persians under King Cyrus. And what happened was the Persians had been looking at this area. If you read in Isaiah, a couple of hundred years earlier, Isaiah had prophesied that Cyrus would come along and would become very wealthy and would have power over a bunch of nations. And a couple hundred years later, not just in Sardis, but around the world at that time, he actually did that. When they got to Sardis, they couldn't figure out, how are we going to attack this place? And they had a soldier that was watching the Lydians as they were walking along the wall up in the upper city, and they saw a soldier's helmet fall down into the valley over the wall, and a few minutes later, that same soldier walked down himself and picked up his helmet and then went back up into the upper city, and this Persian looked and said, you know what, there must be a gate or a door there that we didn't know about. And so they took their army at night, and they went in, and the next morning, Sardis had become a Persian city. What's interesting about that is 200 years later, the Greeks did exactly the same thing. They wanted Sardis. They were watching. I think the story goes there were some buzzards that kept every single day sitting on one particular part of the wall of the Acropolis. The soldiers from the Greek army said, well, there must not be anybody guarding that wall because no one is scaring those buzzards. And so they went and attacked that part of the wall. And the next morning, they did it in the middle of the night, same exact way. The next morning, the city was Greek. And so one of the things about Sardis was, it had this reputation for being a great, big, powerful, affluent city that just out of nowhere, two different times in their history, had gotten complacent and then became vulnerable and then fell into enemy hands. I mentioned the roads already. The gospel, if you look at the seven cities of Revelation and the other cities in the New Testament, almost every one of those is right along those roads. And Sardis had a very prominent first century location. The other thing Steve mentioned last week was the earthquakes, a series of which affected that area of the world in the beginning of the AD first century, around the time of Jesus. In 17 AD, there was a massive earthquake that affected Sardis and the other cities there. Pliny said, the historian said, that it was the greatest earthquake in human memory. And some scholars estimate that it was over 9 on the Richter scale. And what happened was, there used to be 28 acres of livable space on top of this Acropolis, and the entire thing fell straight down off the top of the mountain during that earthquake. The upper city that they had was pretty much gone, and if you look at the city from this side now, you can see that it's more of a spine instead of having a big, flat, livable area. And so they had the lower city, they had the upper city, and now what they did was everybody just moved into this area, which became their middle city. The city now became three sections. That part obviously is unexcavated, but that's where they couldn't build up in the Acropolis, and they just had all the stone and everything was sitting there, so they just rebuilt the city right there. And I think that John is referencing this event in Revelation chapter 16 when he writes, "Then there came flashes of lightning, rumblings, peals of thunder, and a severe earthquake. No earthquake like it has ever occurred since mankind has been on the earth. So tremendous was the quake." Almost exactly the same way Pliny described that earthquake, John does. And then he says, "The great city split into three parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed." Now, the lower city has a ton of stuff that's excavated. We don't have time to look at nearly all of it. We're going to look at just two things really quickly, just so that you can see a little bit of what it was like. This is the gymnasium. That's a photograph. That's not a drawing. The Harvard team reconstructed the west end of the gymnasium, and you get an idea of, first of all, the amount of money they had in their city to build something like this, because that was just one little section of the entire gymnasium. It's an incredible structure. Christy and I were looking. There's a guy standing right there in that photo, which gives you an idea. That side of the wall must have been 50 or 60 feet high in that time. Gymnasium is where the Greeks practiced and taught their worldview. If you know anything about Greek history, man is the measure of all things. And so human achievement, human intelligence, physical beauty, athletic, anything men can do was the utmost, the ultimate. And this is where they practiced that. This area right here would have been the palestra, where they did physical training and games right in here. And then they had a school in there, and that's just kind of the place where, and it was right on the road. So anybody coming into the city would have visited. The interesting thing about it is, at some point later on, Harvard's excavators also found this structure, which is a synagogue that's in the gymnasium. This picture here is taken from a person, I think, standing on top of this and looking down into the synagogue, which is right there. And you can see, I've been in several synagogues in that part of the world and in Israel as well. Never did I see one that big or with that much money that was invested in the decoration. The mosaic floor in there with the marble and the sculptures and just the size of the place. It's an incredible thing. And it fascinates me that the Jewish folks had that much influence that they could put their synagogue in the gymnasium and these two worldviews right next to each other. Because the Jews had an Old Testament worldview, which was that man isn't the measure of all things, God is the measure of all things. And here these two ideas were out in the open side by side. The road would have gone right by up where you see the actual road going there. In fact, maybe you can see a little bit of the excavated part of the road was right on the other side of that synagogue. The other thing that was excavated by the Harvard team was the Kibbalah Temple, which I showed you before. And what would happen on that was anybody who was coming towards Sardis, this temple was outside of the city gates, and they would have visited and made an offering to Kibbalah on their way into the city. I don't have a ton of great pictures, but you can see, again, the size. This is pretty much the way they found it, except for they stacked these two columns. All of these columns would have been that high. This place is just, it's just incredible. Kibbalah was the goddess of fertility, nature, kind of the embodiment of Mother Earth. Some would say it was Artemis or Diana, or some called her Kubaba. She switched, and I just like saying the word Kubaba. I think that's a sweet word. And her symbol was the lion. Most of the artifacts, more than a third to a half of the artifacts they found in Sardis were either lions or were had inscriptions of lions on them. And Kibbalah's story would make a great Lifetime movie, because Kibbalah fell in love with her grandson and vice versa, which is really cool. And but don't do that yourself. And what happened was that her grandson's name was Attis, A-T-T-I-S. And Attis, in order to profess his love and demonstrate his allegiance to Kibbalah, he castrated himself and he died. And the blood went into the ground and a pine tree came up. So the pine tree was one of the symbols that is part of the whole Kibbalah worship thing. Attis resurrected and they had this relation. It was really a cool story. It's awesome. I think it would make a great Lifetime movie. They had, one of the things that happened when I went to this part of the world was, I thought, you know, because I had studied Greek mythology when I was in high school, and I thought, well, nobody really believed that. I mean, it's mythology, you know what I mean? It's nice stories and interesting, and nobody would think that actually really happened. But I think that one of the things that really struck me here and in other places was there was a group of people, at least, that really were committed to these gods to provide for them. In Sardis, every year, on the lunar equinox, the day of the lunar equinox, they started a festival every springtime that was 12 days long in honor of Kibbalah. And all of the people of Sardis, plus people from the surrounding areas, would come, thousands and thousands of people, to participate in this festival that was about 2 weeks long. It's kind of like our Super Bowl celebration. People from all over gather together, building towards the big event. Here's a little bit of a snapshot of what this looked like. On March 15th, they began a 9-day period of abstinence to prepare themselves for the festival. On March 22nd, a pine tree, in honor of her boyfriend / grandson Attis, I think, would be brought through the city of Sardis in a funeral procession, kind of commemorating his death. March 23 was the day of mourning. March 24 is when things got really interesting. That was called the Day of Blood. And in the Greek world, all of their festivals had blood involved. Most of the time it was animal blood because they would sacrifice a goat or a bull or whatever was the... And I don't know if it was because they couldn't catch a lion or they couldn't kill one to sacrifice it. I don't know what it was, or they just liked the whole story with Attis. But instead of using animal blood, it was the blood of the worshipers themselves that would be shed during this festival. Thousands of these people would wear these pristine white robes, and they would parade through the streets of Sardis, and the frenzy that they would work themselves into included scourging and cutting of themselves and shedding of their own blood in various ways, to the point that at the end of the day, at the height of this festival, some of the priests and some of the more committed worshipers, you would say, would emasculate themselves at the altar of Kibbalah. And it was believed that the blood that was on the robes, if you were a worshiper, whether it was your own blood or it got smattered on you from some of the other people, it was believed that that was Kibbalah's blessing on you. Kibbalah is going to provide for you. Kibbalah is going to make your crop fertile this year, or you're going to have your own children, or whatever it might be. And don't tell me they didn't believe, at least some of them, in Kibbalah. Do you know how desperate somebody had, even to just watch this or to stand, hope that some of that blood would get on you? You must be extremely, extremely lonely, looking for some sense of fulfillment. And it's easy for us to judge looking back. I wonder what historians will say as they look back on our culture and they think they did. What did they do? Are you kidding me? They would log onto the internet and they would watch strangers doing what? Billions of dollars were spent on this every year? Are you kidding me? How many kids in their society got aborted every single year? Really? Why didn't they just adopt? Or why didn't they texted while they were driving? Are you serious? While they were driving their cars? No way. I mean, whatever it might be, it's easy for us to think, well, we're not, at least we're, you know, but I wonder. March 25th was called the Day of Joy, the next day after the Day of Blood, because that previous day could not have been the Day of Joy for some, at least, celebrating the resurrection of Attis, and then they had a day of rest. That was Sardis, very affluent, a reputation for complacency from their history, and this mix of very, very different worldviews. The Greek ideology, the Jewish presence there, and then you've got this whole pagan outlook. And then here comes a group of people with the gospel, with the message of Jesus Christ. And how are these going to fit together? And we don't know who started the church or exactly how early it was, but by the time John writes Jesus' words to them, the church had already had developed quite a bit of history. It's late first century. It's 95 AD. And here's what Jesus says to them. If you have your Bibles, we're in Revelation 3, or the verses will be up on the screen. He says, "To the angel of the church of Sardis write, these are the words of him who holds the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know your deeds. You have a reputation of being alive, but you are dead." But you are dead. Now, if there's one possible positive statement that Jesus makes, it's this idea that their reputation was that they were alive. They had a presence in the community. They probably had a great foundation with some very faithful people that were earlier on in the church. They were visible. People knew about the church and sorry, yeah, we know them. Yeah, that's a good church. I mean, maybe that could be thought of as a positive thing until you realize that in, at least at the time of John's writing, from the lips of Jesus, we know that it wasn't true. That this was actually a dead church. Steve refers to this as the zombie church. It looked like it was alive. It was walking around. It was a real thing. But on the inside, it was nothing. Now, dead how? I mean, what does dead mean? I think by this time, most of the people in the church of Sardis were unbelievers. I think that they had drifted so far from where they had started, and we'll see this in the text. There's a few very faithful people that remain, but for the most part, they couldn't distinguish between whether or not they were had put their trust in Christ or not. They had just gotten too far away, and probably most of the people here had never made an authentic faith commitment to Jesus Christ. There's no indication from history or from the text that there's any persecution. There's no evidence that there was doctrinal issues or any heresy that went through the church. We don't know of any unity problems. It seemed like a peaceable, none of that. Their issue was complacency. It was complacency. I was reading this report. There's this organization called Gray Owl Aviation, and they do research about airline accidents and plane malfunctions and stuff like that, not just big ones where the planes come out of the sky, but anything related to that. And they have discovered that 80% of all of those cases, and they've researched a bunch, are due to human error. Just 20% have to do with the malfunction of the equipment. And in almost every single case of human error, complacency is the issue. I found that really fascinating. They have two, in their report, they had two definitions of complacency. One is unjustified self-satisfaction accompanied by a low awareness of the need for action. The second one is conscious or unconscious relaxation of one's usual standards in making decisions and taking action. So it's this idea that people get satisfied, they get comfortable, they get relaxed, and it causes poor decision-making and an inability to act in the way that they know they're supposed to act. And in the airline industry, what they decided was that there's really two issues. One is the airplanes themselves are so reliable that the people are like, nothing's ever going to happen. I've never even come close to being in a situation where something's gone wrong. And then the jobs are so familiar. These maintenance technicians, they've looked at so many wheel wells or wing flaps or whatever it might be that they lose the sense of urgency that's involved with their job. They forget that actual people with actual families are getting on these planes and lives are at stake. I just can't imagine. But then again, I can, because it's exactly what happens. That's what shipwrecks in many cases, churches and also our own spiritual lives. When we forget the implications of what we're doing to the extent that we stop doing what we know is best, what we know is right, that's complacency. Peter Drucker is a management guy that's very well known, and he said this. He said, the problem in my life and other people's lives is not the absence of knowing what to do, but the absence of doing it. And if you know anything about Peter, I read that and I go, Peter Drucker struggles with complacency? That's crazy. It makes me feel a little better about the issues that I have myself with this. Because complacency, it creeps in. It eats away at our relationships. Because relationships require attention to survive and to thrive. It can really affect our work environment, especially if we have a job that has a lot of repetition. And it's a killer of our faith, both for individual people and for entire church communities, because it can create this environment like was present in Sardis, where the people, there's nothing wrong with having a church full and it's welcoming to unbelievers, but when the people involved don't know the difference, and it's predominantly led by people who have never put their trust and faith in Jesus, then everybody is confused, everybody's lost. Now, I'll say this. I don't think that this is the way that Jesus would describe Riverview. Personally, I've looked through all the different letters. I'm not sure which one would be the closest, but it could be someday. It could be someday if we get complacent. We could easily get there. And I think one of the things that I've appreciated in the last couple of years as I've been getting to know the leaders and stuff and the way things work around here is the diligence with which the folks that lead this church pay close attention to everything that's going on so that they can keep the focus on the gospel the way the church started. Complacency diminishes our influence on the world around us, again, as churches, as individual believers. G.B. Caird said that Sardis was the perfect model of inoffensive Christianity. Everybody knew about them, but no one was being challenged by them. They weren't calling the community to repent, to put their trust in Jesus. And here's the thing I think that's the most dangerous with complacency is it's almost always a step towards compromise. We drift, and then all of a sudden, right, we're in this place, and it's like, well, how did my marriage get so, or how did I get into this sin area of my life that I don't, and it's like it wasn't all of a sudden. And I think that's the scary part for me about complacency. Now, in that airline industry report, they gave a prescription. They said, you know what, we just need to face reality. The good news about it is there's no cost. All we have to do is have the people do exactly what they're doing, but with a different attitude and a different mentality, remembering exactly who they are, what their training was, and why they're here, and why this is urgent. They need to wake up. And it's exactly the same prescription that Jesus gives to the church in Sardis, using the same words. In fact, in Revelation 3, he says, "Wake up, strengthen what remains and is about to die, for I have found your deeds unfinished in the sight of my God." And in the Greek, it's kind of this staccato, urgent. It's like, wake up. You need to wake up. There's something there that still you're hanging on to, just this remnant of something that was there before. And if you don't strengthen, this church is on its deathbed. If you don't strengthen it, it will die. By looking at your deeds, there's no evidence of faith in Jesus here, or very little. It's this pay attention, this ongoing focus on your faith, on your life. This is everywhere in the Bible. I mean, I think it's wake up in one moment sense, and then it's this kind of ongoing progression. In 1 Timothy 4, it says, Paul writes to Timothy, he says, pay close attention to your life and to your doctrine. In 1 Peter 5, he says, be alert. Same Greek word that he used when it's translated wake up in Revelation 3. Be alert and of sober mind. Your enemy, the devil, prowls around like a roaring lion, like Kibbalah, looking for someone to devour. Resist him, standing firm in the faith, because you know that the family of believers throughout the world is undergoing the same kind of sufferings. And then here's a promise. He says, and the God of grace, in other words, if you do that, if you keep attentive, if you stay sober, alert, resist, stand firm, the God of grace who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you. See, there's hope for this church in Sardis because of the God of grace who restores, makes strong, firm, and steadfast. And then Jesus gets really practical. What does this wake up look like? How do I do that? And it strikes me that the first thing that we need to remember is this is a letter to a church. And so we need to do this together. It would be really, really unhelpful, I think, for each of us to leave today thinking, okay, I need to wake up, and you need to wake up, and you go do it separately, and we'll all go our own way. This is to the angel of the church in Sardis, to the people there. When I was in college, I played on the tennis team, and we traveled and would stay in hotels, and then we had early morning matches a lot on in the next morning. And we had developed this system that was fairly elaborate to help each other wake up in the morning. I don't know if you've ever been to a hotel. I need a wake-up call every single morning, okay? Almost never do I wake up at exactly the moment that I need to wake up. And so we would call the front desk and say, okay, can you call us at 6:50 and then 6:58 and then 7:04? And then we each had our alarm, and then we would wake each other up, and then we would have, and we would give each other permission in advance, because when the time would come, we would be like, don't you touch me. I'm going to, you know what I mean? How that works, right? And I just wonder in our lives who we have given permission to say, watch my life. It could be somebody in our family or life group or on our ministry team. And if you see this drift for me, I just want you to just come and put your arm around me and just wake up and just snap me back to reality. Because if we drift, we need each other in this. And then here's what Jesus says. He says, remember, therefore, what you have received and heard. He's talking there about the gospel, the good news of Jesus Christ that the people in Sardis had received, they had heard, but apparently they had forgotten. They had forgotten because they weren't giving it their attention. This, for us, the good news about Jesus, this is God's consistent voice in our lives. If we consistently are reading it, remembering what we have seen and what we have heard. And some of you, I know, immediately go, I get stuck with the Bible. I don't know where to get started. It's overwhelming. That's why Greg Van Ada, one of the pastors here, he and I are excited about this class that we're doing the next three Sundays during the 11:30. It's going to help folks that are looking for some accountability and direction in that area. And this idea of remembering, it's all over the Bible. Here's Deuteronomy chapter 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your strength. There's the command. And I think that's one that we all want. We all want to love God with everything we've got. Okay, how do I do that? He says, these commandments that I give you today are to be on your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home and when you walk on the road and when you lie down and when you get up. All the time. Tie them as symbols on your hands and bind them on your foreheads. Write them on the door frames of your houses and on your gates. He's basically saying, remember, 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 remember. Do this together. Talk to each other all the time. Staple it to your forehead if you need to. Whatever it takes. Now, why? Why is this urgent? Why not just be complacent and drift and slide and just be satisfied? Well, here's what he says. For when the Lord your God brings you into the land he swore to his fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give you, a land with large, flourishing cities you did not build, houses filled with all kinds of good things you did not provide, wells you did not dig, and vineyards and olive groves you did not plant, then when you eat and are, what's that word? Satisfied. In other words, when you move to Sardis, or when you move to America, and everything's so safe and secure and provided for you, and it's this affluence, and you're tempted to believe that all of those things are the things that you can put your trust in, and you're about to get to the point where you become satisfied, complacent, with things that you didn't have anything to do with in the first place, then watch yourself that you do not forget the Lord who brought you out of Egypt. He just saved them when this was written. He just saved us. And yet here we could turn around and forget. And so what he's doing here, the writer is giving us a prescription in advance. You're going to face the temptation to become complacent. And so remember, remember, remember what you have seen and what you have heard. And he doesn't stop there. Jesus, in Revelation 3, he says, remember therefore what you have received and heard. And then he says, keep it and repent. Little snack. Let's go this way. That's a little sticky. Now, I can feel that. I got a little something on my face. Because normally I don't have something hanging there on my face. And so because it's there and it's not usually there, I can feel it. Now, if I were to just leave it there for a long time, I would get used to it. That's complacency, right? Got a little bit on my finger here, too. Now, there's two ways that this big glob of goo can get off my face, right? Some of you who know me well, if they saw me, they would go, oh, let's just let him leave it on there for the rest of the day, right? Here's my dork. How did he get, you know? But those of you who care about me, some of you who don't know me might give me one of these, you know, kind of thing, you know. Some of you would just say, hey, man, you have a stain on your face. What the heck? If my mom was here, she would lick her finger and wipe it off. I'm 42 years old, right? She would get that thing off of there. Now, the other way right, I've got this mirror right here. You see yourself in there? Oh, look, it lights you up. Excellent. That's just what you were looking for. That's why you sat in the dark today. You guys see each other? See yourselves there? Hey, you look good. Some people love the mirror. Some people are really upset that I'm doing this. They hate the mirror, right? Guys in the back, see? I can't figure, you know. Some people have a love-hate relationship with the mirror. Depends on the day, right? I look good today. Or the mirror. That mirror doesn't make me look very good. I love that mirror because it makes me look good. But that's the other way, right? I could go over here and I could, whoa! And realize. Now here's James. Listen to James. Not me, but James, reading James. Chapter 1. Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. Anyone who listens to the word but does not do what it says is like someone who looks at his face in a mirror and after looking at himself goes away immediately and forgets what he looks like. Just because I saw doesn't mean I took the key step. But whoever looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues in it, not forgetting what they have heard, but doing it, they will be blessed in what they do. What is that made of? My shrunk. Mostly comes off there. I don't think that's actual food, what's in that donut there. The step of actually keeping, of doing something. This is God's way of reflecting you back to you. And remembering what you have seen and heard is critical. Keeping it and repenting. Repenting is just changing your direction. In other words, don't be the complacent Christian or the complacent church. You can be different. It's remember and keep. Pay attention and repent. Not merely a hearer, but a doer. I think that maybe is why Sardis got to the point that they got to. They stopped doing what they knew they needed to do. And here again, the words of Jesus. One warning and then some promises to finish us up. Revelation 3:3. But if you do not wake up, I will come like a thief, and you will not know at what time I will come to you. I mean, you think the people of Sardis felt bad when the Persians or the Greeks invaded their Acropolis while they were sleeping? I mean, it caught them completely by surprise. Imagine how they're going to feel when Jesus shows up unexpectedly. There is an urgency to this. We cannot simply wait. We're not living by what's true. Lives are at stake. And the cool thing is, I think this is exactly what Sardis did, because by 150 to 200 AD, within 50 to 100 years, there was a booming church community, Many scholars say over 50%. Some say 80% of the entire city had become Christian by that time. I think they did wake up. I think they did repent and keep and move forward. Maybe the positive comment about their church is that they are the they finally got it church. I don't know. We'll see someday. And then Jesus continues on and finishes his comments. Yet, you have a few people in Sardis who have not soiled their clothes. They will walk with me dressed in white, for they are worthy. Now, I happen to think Jesus here was referring directly to the festival of Kibbalah that happened every single March in their town. And if he was, I think that's just hilarious myself. That's hilarious to me. Were there some church members who participated in that kind of worship, in that kind of activity, who got so close that some of the blood that their clothes got soiled, who said they believed in Jesus, but really they wanted the stain of the culture to get on them? That's where they were putting their faith, putting their trust. We don't know if that was the case. Probably, but we can't say. Here's what we do know. Jesus uses this image to urge people to put their trust in him. You don't need to get the blood of the culture on you to save you, to fulfill you, to sustain you. He says, I shed my blood on the cross so that you could be dressed in white. I paid it all. Sin had left a crimson stain. I, says Jesus, washed it white as snow. That's from Isaiah chapter 1. He says, the one who overcomes, in other words, the one who puts their faith in me, will, like them, be dressed in white. I will never blot out the name of that person from the book of life, but will acknowledge that name before my Father and his angels. Whoever has ears, now here's a message for everybody, is what he's saying. Let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. Think about that for a second, that last little image. Can you imagine Jesus standing before the Father and the angels, and they open up the book of life, and they go, okay, well, who's up next? Well, it's James Granger. Okay. Well, which one? The good-looking one, yeah. Remember. And it's like, yes, his name is, and the angels go, yes. Never will his name, because he put his trust in me, says Jesus, be erased from the book of life. Never. All right, who's next? Josh Beckwith. Oh, yes, he's in there. Seriously, he's in there? Yeah, he's in there. And on and on. Have you overcome? Is it time for you to wake up and to put your trust in Jesus? If you do, the promise is this: you will walk with him in white, and your name will forever be written in the book of life.